This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This morning, the Supreme Court heard arguments on the emotionally charged issue of school desegregation. The nine justices heard two cases that center on the use of race as one factor in public school assignments. In both cases, Seattle, Washington and Louisville, Kentucky, it is widely acknowledged that placing kids based solely on the neighborhoods they live in would mean all or virtually all black schools in some places and white schools in others. Following a previous Supreme Court decision, Seattle, Louisville and hundreds of other school districts around the country use race as one factor in school placement. Parents in Seattle and Louisville challenged those assignments and arguing that their children ended up being bused to another part of town as part of an unconstitutional racial quota. Lower courts upheld the school districts. Protesters on both sides chanted and waved placards outside the Supreme Court on a cold, windy morning in Washington, D.C. We're going to play substantial excerpts of today's arguments for you, and we'll hear from lawyers for and against. If you have questions about these cases or whether the benefits of integration outweigh the use of race or vice versa, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Later on the Talk of the Nation opinion page, tech populism and the power of mainstream media. But first, race, integration, and public schools. We begin with David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times, and he was at today's session earlier today. He's joining us here today in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program again, David.
Hi, Neil.
And the Supreme Court issued now famous decisions on the use of race as a factor in university and law school admissions a couple of years ago. Is it fair to say with these cases the justices revisit this same issue for grades K through 12?
Yes, this sort of goes all the way back to the original Brown versus Board of Education case from 50-some years ago, where the court struck down racial segregation laws in the South, talked about separate schools being inherently unequal. Sort of leaves the question is, if you're a school board member, should you take from that, I have a duty to integrate the schools? Or is the court telling me I may not assign students to school based on race?
Mm-hmm.
This is a case where both sides were sort of saying the legacy of the Brown decision bolsters my case. One side says for integration, the other side says don't assign students based on their race.
And these two cases, Seattle, Washington, Louisville, Kentucky, different in some respects, in the number of grades covered, but also in their history. Louisville was under court order for integration for many years.
Yes, that's exactly right, Neil. I actually thought that would play a bigger role in this case than it did. A lot of us who follow the court were wondering why they took two cases.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, Seattle doesn't have a history of legal segregation. Louisville does. I thought, and some others thought, there's at least a possibility they're going to view them differently. The justices, though, seem to view it as exactly the same case. But they were doing slightly different ways, but they use racial guidelines to achieve integration.
Mm-hmm. We're going to play some tapes of the exchanges between the attorneys and justices. First, we're going to hear an excerpt from the opening argument of the attorney for the parents in this case, Harry Correll, where he lays out the problem as he sees it.
The central question in this case is not, as the school district and many of its allies suggest, whether integration is important or whether desegregation is compelling. The central question in this case is whether, outside of the remedial context, diversity, defined as the school district does, as a white, non-white racial balance, can be a compelling interest that justifies the use of race discrimination in high school admissions.
And that's the argument against the use of what he would argue were racial quotas. What was the argument on behalf of the school boards?
Well, the argument on the school board's behalf is that we want some integration in our city. The north side of the city in Seattle apparently has a largely white population. The south side is more minority. If we don't do something, our schools are all going to be segregated, at least very racially imbalanced. This only affects a relative handful of kids. It's for a good purpose. So, why not let us do this good thing?
Mm-hmm. In this next exchange, we're going to hear Justice Anthony Kennedy ask the attorney for the school boards, that's Michael Madden, whether Seattle's plan amounts to, quote, outright racial imbalancing. Let's listen.
In Grutter, we said, and I'll shorten it just a little bit, at page 329 and 330 of the U.S. Reports 539, the law school's interest is not simply to assure within its student body some specified percentage of a particular group because of race. That would amount to outright racial balancing, which is patently unconstitutional. And that, it seems to me, what you have here.
I think that the term racial balancing has kind of two significant meanings. One is a plan that does not foster a compelling interest, and second, a plan that's too rigid, a quota, for instance, that might not pass narrow tailoring given the context. In this case, we're not after a rigid set of numbers, and certainly not after a rigid set of numbers for their own sake. The purpose was to have schools that had become diverse through integration efforts not stray too far from the community's demographic, because we're trying to prepare students to live in those communities.
The problem is that, unlike strategic siting, magnet schools, special resources, special programs in some schools, you are characterizing each student by reason of the color of his or her skin. That is quite a different means, and it seems to me that should only be, if ever allowed, allowed as a last resort.
Justice Kennedy there, and David Savage. Justice Kennedy is actually seen now as the swing vote on this court, particularly on this issue. Was decided 5-4 the last time, and he was among the four. So at this point, that doesn't, from the excerpt we heard, he seemed to be challenging the attorney for the school districts quite heavily.
Yes, I think you heard the outcome to the case in a nutshell. I think that's the way the case will come out, because Kennedy is the deciding vote on these issues. He's been very strongly of the view that the government should not use race to make decisions. Some people thought he might see this differently as higher education, on the grounds that in higher education, somebody wins and somebody loses mm-hmm. in an affirmative action plan. Some of the civil rights people thought we might be able to convince Justice Kennedy that school integration is a different matter. It sounded to me he saw it as just exactly the same. It's outright racial balancing, and you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Here's another excerpt, and in it we're going to hear first from Justice Samuel Alito, later from Justice Antonin Scalia. And they're talking about the use of the word by the attorney on behalf of the school boards, the use of the word segregation to describe the ultimate result of some of these actions if these systems are undone. And that's a word that they have problems with.
There have been.
Do you think your schools, as they're operated now, are segregated?
We have some change of conditions, but the basic conditions remain. The trend has not been positive. For example, and I think the petitioner
Segregated. You refer to some of the schools as segregated. That's not what I understand by segregated.
Not in the sense.
You know, if you belong to a country club that has 15% black members, I would not consider that a segregated country club. So what you're complaining about is not segregation in any reasonable sense of that word. You're complaining about a lack of racial balance.
We are not complaining about segregation resulting from purposeful discrimination. That's
the only meaning of segregation.
I agree.
You're talking about racial balance.
Talking about schools that are, on the one end, racially isolated. The Solicitor General mentioned two of those. And talking on the other end about preserving the diversity that we had achieved through these years of effort in these North End schools.
I think you're also necessarily.
And the arguments continued, David Savage, that distinction saying, it seemed to be saying that, you know, the argument that these schools would end up racially imbalanced as a result of neighborhood decisions without busing, Justice Scalia particularly objecting to the use of word segregation to define that.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, Scalia has the view that goes back to the Brown case that segregation is a bad thing because the state, by law, is separating kids. A lot of school people say our schools are still, quote, segregated because they're largely black in one area, largely white in another area. Scalia is saying that's not segregation. That's racial imbalance. It's a completely different matter.
And we're going to hear one more clip of tape before we go to the break. And this is sort of about the philosophical argument here. Is the use of racial information justified for the benefits of integration? We'll begin with Chief Justice John Roberts.
The reason that our prior tests have focused on individual determination is that the purpose of the Equal Protection Clause is to ensure that people are treated as individuals rather than based on the color of their skin. So saying that this doesn't involve individualized determinations simply highlights the fact that the decision to distribute, as you put it, is based on skin color and not any other factor.
Mr. Chief Justice, in Grutter, you said specifically that individualized review was required in the context of university admissions. In this context, the kind of review, the specific kind of review that I understand the United States to urge and the petitioner to urge, serves no purpose, and it may itself be stigmatizing in the context of public school where everyone gets a seat.
You're saying that the individual treatment makes no sense in terms of the objective here.
I
thought that's what you...
Justice Ginsburg, that is correct. I am saying, however, that this plan, consistent with narrow tailoring, provided consideration of individual circumstances, including an appeal on hardship grounds for someone who felt that they had been denied a school that they needed to be in.
Well, the emphasis on the fact that everybody gets into a school, it seems to me, is misplaced. The question is whether or not you can get into the school that you really prefer. And that, in some cases, depends solely on skin color. It's like saying that everybody can have the meal, but only people of a separate skin can get the dessert.
Well, like the Michigan cases, sometimes students, in the end of the day, have an assignment determined by race. Just like in the university cases, at some point, race will be a tipping factor. Different, though, we put someone in a basically comparable school.
Well, you're saying everyone got a seat in Brown as well, but because they were assigned to those seats on the basis of race, it violated equal protection. How is your argument that there's no problem here because everybody gets a seat distinguishable?
Because segregation is harmful. Integration, as this court has recognized in Swan and the first Seattle case, has benefits.
Excerpts from today's Supreme Court arguments in two cases involving the use of race to place students in public school systems, Louisville, Kentucky, and Seattle, Washington. We'll take your questions about these cases after we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This morning, the United States Supreme Court heard arguments in two cases where school districts use race as a factor in deciding where children may go to school. 2 years ago, the court upheld limited race-based admissions in higher education. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions about these cases or whether the benefits of integration outweigh their use of race or vice versa, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest is David Savage, who covered this morning's hearings on behalf of the Los Angeles Times. He's with us here in Studio 3A. And David, the excerpts that we heard a moment ago seem to show the person representing the school districts playing defense against the conservatives on the court. Is that representative of what happened in today's session?
Yes, absolutely, for 2 hours. As you heard in that last excerpt, the school attorney is saying, we're doing this for a good purpose. We want to achieve integration. And John Roberts and Anthony Kennedy are saying, no, what counts is the means that you're doing it. The Equal Protection Clause says you can't discriminate against any individual based on race. You are discriminating against some individual white students, and the Constitution says you can't do that. So
the ends don't justify the means.
Right.
Even though the end is a good end, integration of schools, that doesn't mean you can't violate the Constitution on the way.
That's absolutely right.
We're going to hear arguments from attorneys on both sides of this issue. We begin with Sharon Brown, who's with us here in Studio 3A. She's a principal attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, a nonprofit public interest law firm in Sacramento, California. Pacific Legal Foundation filed amicus briefs in support of the parents in these school cases. It's a pleasure to welcome you to Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Why do the rights of the individual outweigh the benefits of integration?
The Equal Protection Clause makes it very clear that the rights go to the individual. It's not a group right. Every individual has a right to make sure that the government treats them equally without regard to their race. And in doing so, they're providing equal treatment as well as equal opportunities. In these two cases, what happened is the school district classified each student on the basis of their race. They said they were either other, non-white, black, or just simply white. Mm-hmm. They did not... You look at each child as an individual. Based upon that racial classification, that child was assigned to one of the public schools.
As I understand it, that was just one factor. Neighborhood was a factor, and also if you had a sibling in the school, that was also a factor.
But it was clear that race was the tipping factor that would decide whether or not the student goes to one school or another school. Take, for example, Joshua McDonald. He was a 5-year-old kindergarten student in Jefferson County, Kentucky. He was denied a choice of schools simply because he was the wrong color of skin. He was white, but if he had been black, he would have been accepted to the other school. Instead, the school district was willing to leave that seat vacant.
Presumably, if he'd been on the other side of town, the racial equation would have worked the other way.
Not necessarily. The equations in both Kentucky as well as Seattle impact both students, whether or not you're minority or white. They do impact both, depending upon what school you want to go to. In the Seattle School District case, 300 students were denied the school of their choice, and over almost 100 of those students happened to be minority. So it does impact both students, and the simple matter is that the school districts are classifying the students on the basis of race and then using that student's race in deciding where that student's going to go, regardless of the parental's choice, regardless of what school would actually benefit the child better than another school.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Again, it's 800-989-8255, and this is Donna. Donna calling us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I was a student in 1978 in the Jefferson County Public School System when it was desegregated. And I was in middle school, but had formerly gone to an all-white elementary school in a white neighborhood. There were two children of color in the entire elementary school. So now that my children attend the school, and my daughter attends the school that this child in Louisville attends, it's one of the best schools in the city. I certainly understand why his mother would have wanted him to go there. But there is a system in place. Many of us put our children in the public school system by choice. There's economic opportunities to choose any of the private schools, but it's a wonderful system, and it would be an absolute shame for this one parent to change the entire system. My children go to school with a complete mix socioeconomic. There's doctors' kids. There's kids that live in assisted housing. There's kids who are sort of middle class and regular like we are. And it is a wonderful system, and my kids are learning, and I know that all the children there, it's a wonderful.
And Donna, you would support that system even if it required your kids to get on a bus and go all the way across town to a different school?
Absolutely. And the wonderful thing about it, I think this has not really been covered, is that the system is that every child is assigned a home school. Where you live, you can go right in your neighborhood. You can choose a magnet school, which we have sort of the arts, performing arts schools, to science, to math, to whatever the child's sort of chosen skills are, where the parents want to see their kids. And it's a very competitive system, and the reason why is because the schools are so good. So it stands to reason that there have to be guidelines for children to be chosen, and there has to be some deciding factor.
And in some cases, that's race. So, Sharon Brown, let's get a response from you.
Well, that's the problem, is the deciding factor is race. Now, the school districts can use other factors that do not violate the Constitution. They can use parent education. They can use socioeconomic factors. They could even open up the schools to open enrollment and then use a lottery in assigning students to public schools, but what they cannot do is using race as a classification. And the race seems to follow the child through the school system and into their adult life. And if we're trying to educate our students to ensure that race does not matter, that we're looking at everyone as individuals, teaching that child at 5 years old and on up that their race means more than individual characteristics, we're never going to get beyond the racial problems in this country.
Donna, I'm sure you have other points that you could make in argument, but I'm going to let it go. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call very much. But I did want to follow up Sharon Brown and say the argument ad absurdo presented by your opponents would be if it was dismantled on the basis of this suit and the schools went back to effectively resegregate, as so many school districts around this country have largely done in the past 20, 25 years. If effectively it means the Louisville schools and the Seattle schools are resegregated, is that an acceptable alternative?
The school districts can always use different alternatives, and there have been numerous ideas where they can actually do alternatives, such as they can use magnet schools, they can use neighborhood schools, they can use open enrollment. They can even put new programs, new buildings in certain areas, and it will draw students to those schools. What the parents are looking for is providing the best educational opportunities for their kids. And they don't look at this on the basis of race. They're looking at it as educational opportunities.
Sharon Brown, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate your time. Sharon Brown is principal attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, a nonprofit public interest law firm in Sacramento that filed amicus briefs in support of the parents in both cases that the Supreme Court heard arguments in today. For an opposing view, we're joined by Michael Small, an attorney in the Los Angeles law firm of Akin Gump and former deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration. He filed amicus briefs on behalf of the National School Board Association in support of the two schools in this case, and he joins us from our studios at NPR West. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And what is the argument against the idea that this is unconstitutional use of racial quotas?
Well, the use of the word quota here is a misnomer. The Supreme Court has made clear in cases dating back to the Bakke decision in the late 70s that public institutions may consider race in admissions context in higher education. These cases pose the question of whether they can be considered with respect to student assignments in K-12 public education. The use of race as one factor in the decision-making calculus to promote a larger compelling objective is not unconstitutional. And in these cases, Seattle and Louisville are seeking to achieve the compelling objective of eliminating racial isolation in K-12 public education and ensuring that students of both races attend school with students of other races to break down stereotypes and to ultimately demonstrate that race doesn't matter. Ms. Brown suggested that these programs teach students that race does matter. And in fact, the research shows that where school boards use these types of programs, students ultimately see that whatever stereotypes they came in with about a black student or a white student are incorrect.
One of the arguments on behalf of, in particular, Louisville was, in fact, that school district was ordered to use a busing system to achieve racial balancing by federal court order for decades.
Right. David Savage mentioned this as well. One of the differences between the Seattle plan and Louisville plan is that Louisville comes with a history of mandated racial segregation of the schools. A lawsuit filed nearly two decades after the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education, this lawsuit filed in the 1970s, argued that Louisville was still operating racially segregated schools, segregated by force of law. Ultimately, a federal court entered a decree that required the Louisville School District to take measures, including race-conscious measures, to eliminate the vestiges of that discrimination. That decree was lifted in 2000. But up until 2000, Louisville was under court order to use race to desegregate the schools. The position of the other side in these cases is that at some point, the day after the school decree, the court decree was lifted, what was constitutionally required the next day became constitutionally prohibited. And those on our side of the case think that's a perverse result.
Let's get another caller in on the line. This is Edie. Edie calling us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is that, at least it's been my understanding, I went to Cleveland Public Schools and we were mandated to desegregate the school system. And that went on for 25 years in our school district, in Cleveland Public School District, which it's no longer happening. But I was always under the impression that the reason why we had desegregation was to make sure that all the children in the Cleveland District had the best education possible, and that there was an insinuation that possibly the children who were in the minority side of the town had the educators that weren't as adequate as the ones on the other side of the town where a majority of the white families lived. And what I do remember as a child is going to what was called the supplementary center, and all of the children from all the districts would come together and have different activities, and it was a very wonderful learning experience for all of us. Unfortunately, they no longer use the supplementary center in Cleveland. However, I think that, you know, I think we're missing the goal, and I think that we need to think outside the box in how we want to ensure that all of our children receive the best education possible. Hmm. And maybe that's looking at our educators.
Get a response, Michael Small?
I actually think that in these cases, these school districts have thought outside the box. What these school districts have done is offered parents a choice. The school districts did not have to offer the parents a choice. They could have assigned students to the neighborhood schools and thereby perpetuate the racial isolation of the public schools. But they offered the parents the choice. And in fact, virtually all the parents in Seattle and Louisville get their first choice of school. It is only in a limited number of cases in Louisville, 5%, that parents don't get their first choice, and in Seattle, it's slightly more. It seems to me that's creative thinking, and school districts around the nation have looked at the problem, studied the problem, and in the exercise of local control, they have responded to the needs and interests of their communities and reached a judgment based on strong empirical foundation that racially integrated education is crucial to their mission of ensuring, as the caller said, to ensure that all students receive the best possible education.
Edie, thanks very much for the call. We're discussing today's Supreme Court arguments on race and public schools. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I guess, Michael Small, the question that follows on from that is the question that was raised by the other side. If the means to achieve those laudable goals are unconstitutional, then we have to think further outside the box. We can't use those means.
This is true, and there may be other means at the disposal of public school districts to try to achieve racial diversity in K-12 public education, but the evidence in these cases and elsewhere around the country suggests that if these tools are eliminated, completely eliminated from the toolkit of local school boards, there will be increased segregation and de facto segregation, not lawful segregation, but de facto segregation because of the racial identity of neighborhoods.
Because of the racial housing patterns in these
yes.
and many other cities across the country.
Precisely.
Obviously, this affects many district places other than Seattle and Louisville. David Savage, as you listen to the arguments you told us earlier, you seem to hear a suggestion that the court's conservative majority is going to win out on this one.
Yes, absolutely. It certainly sounded that way. I think this case is important for two reasons. One is the one we've been talking about, the school integration. It sure looks like there's going to be a 5-member majority to say no racial guidelines for school integration, even though it's a good purpose. Also, I think this may be the beginning of a 5-vote majority to say no use of race by the government under any circumstances. In other words, the school districts were relying on the Grutter case, the affirmative action case from Michigan.
The University of Michigan Law School, I think.
Yes, that was a 5-4 opinion with Justice O'Connor in the majority upholding affirmative action. I think if that same case came back again, it would come out the other way, that I think 5 of the justices now are inclined to take the view that the government may not make racial classifications, dole out benefits in any way based on the race of the recipients, and that'll go beyond just the school integration context.
And this, of course, the new court with two justices named by President Bush, Chief Justice Roberts replacing Chief Justice Rehnquist. That vote is seen as a wash.
Right.
The big change, Justice
Alito.
Justice Alito mm-hmm. Replacing Sandra Day O'Connor.
Right. So it looks like a 5-4 majority the other way.
Okay. Thanks very much. Michael Small, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Small, an attorney in the Los Angeles firm of Akin Gump, who filed amicus briefs on behalf of the National School Board Association in support of the two school districts in the case. They were the defendants. Also, our thanks to David Savage, the Supreme Court reporter of the Los Angeles Times, who took the time to join us here in Studio 3A. David, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
When we come back from a short break, it's the Talk of the Nation opinion page and an argument that mainstream media is muscling out the amateurs in online video. So, what do you YouTube? Join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. We'll be back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.